Welcome to Writer Writer Pants on Fire, where authors talk about things that never happened to people who don't exist. I'm your host, Mindy McGinnis. You can check out my books and social media at mindymcginnis.com and visit the Writer Writer Pants on Fire blog at writerwriterpantsonfire.blogspot.com. Today's guest is Lydia Kang, author of the sci-fi YA novels Control and Catalyst, as well as many upcoming works across different genres. She joined me to talk about the grueling amount of work involved in acquiring an agent and being deeply invested in your story for its own sake. I always start by asking my guests about their querying journey and how they landed their agent. So tell us a little bit about that.
I went into the whole process not really knowing a whole lot about anything. And so I had written my first book in the span of a month, which basically means I didn't really sleep and it was pretty terrible. And I decided I would give myself one summer to land an agent, sell a book, or else I was going to give up. Very unrealistic. So that summer, after I'd finished writing the book, I looked up and I found out the whole thing about querying. And I started sending some letters out and I had it looked over by some people on Query Tracker. That was sort of one of my first communities. They looked over my letter and fixed it a little bit. I started getting a lot of rejections just right off the bat. And I remember getting a couple that were like, hey, your writing's not bad, but this has been overdone. It had a lot of paranormal elements to it. And I think that if I had gotten a lot more just flat rejections with no personalization, I might have really rethought the whole process. It gave me enough encouragement that I was like, all right, I'm going to keep trying. I was pretty determined. I have a tendency to be like, here's a goal. I think I'm going to get it. And I'm going to just put all of my energy into it. But so far it's worked out. You know, I graduated from college, got into residency, and I'm just like, I'm going to keep trying something else and we'll see if I fail. I queried like crazy in the United States. And after I wasn't really getting the bites that I wanted, I'm like, well, forget the US. I'm going to try Canada. I'm going to try the UK. I got a nibble in the UK. I was encouraged enough that I thought I would keep trying. So I wrote a second book. That one was historical. The first one was paranormal. I learned really, really quickly that I was not as good of a writer as I needed to be. And I started just looking up everything that I could online about writing and craft and started to get better, got some really good beta readers. And so my querying went from like sort of spaghetti method, like just go and query everybody that I could, to being a lot more picky, to understanding that if my response rate was not as good, there was something wrong with my letter. If my partial and full response rate was not as good, it's because my writing needed fixing or my first five pages needed fixing. My learning curve that year was incredibly steep. So by the end of the year, I had two novels under my belt, getting better and better nibbles, but still not actually getting a deal. And that's when I wrote Control. It was sort of the first time that my beta readers were telling me that I had done something way above and beyond quality-wise in my first two novels. And they said, this one could be on a shelf. After querying for about 6 months on that one, I got two offers of representation. And I ended up going with Eric Myers, who was at a different agency at the time. He's now with Distill and Goderich. That's how it happened. But the whole process, probably from the day that I decided I was going to write a novel to getting a book deal, was about 2.5 years. It was pretty short.
Which a lot of people don't realize. I would say that the average from talking to many different authors is about 7 years. So 2.5 is actually pretty fast. I'm curious about your process then when you're writing. If you executed three finished novels in 2 years while you were also working full-time. Is that correct?
Yes and no. I was not working full-time. I was part-time. I know there are several other physician writers that do work full-time. I.W. Gregorio comes to mind. She's a full-time neurologist. Having that extra time in my schedule made a huge, huge difference. But I was eating, sleeping, breathing, writing for that two-year period. It was very, very immersive. And I was quite obsessed with pushing myself really, really hard. So it was a lot of work. I don't want to say that 2.5 years, no big deal. It was hard work. I always want to caution new writers about like, oh yeah, if you just do it, it'll happen pretty soon. I was really lucky. I was lucky. Control was science fiction. Science fiction and dystopian was super hot at the moment. And I hadn't quite anticipated that. Like, you never exactly know what people are going to want to pick up right then and there. At the time, it was planets kind of aligned. My writing quality improved just in time. I mean, it was very lucky. It was like winning the lottery.
My first published book, Not a Drop to Drink, was my fifth novel I'd ever written. And again, it was a combined happenstance of a hot genre, which at the time was post-apocalyptic dystopian society, mm-hmm. and my writing having finally hit a publishable state. You can never predict the marketplace. You never know what the next big thing is going to be. My personal thought is that you have to write whatever story is in your head that wants to be written right now, whatever that may be. And hopefully it is a genre that is selling or will be selling.
Right. I don't do well with writing things I'm not interested in. It just mm-hmm. doesn't work for me. I was in love with the story at the time, and that's just sort of what I had to do. I think the thing that's so frustrating about the publishing business is even if your agent and your editor are thinking like, this is great, this is hot, it's going to be awesome, it's still in traditional publishing at least takes like, what, 1 to 2 years?
At least.
What actually comes out, and by then people might be like, I'm so sick of science fiction now. I don't want to read any books anymore.
Not a Drop to Drink got in right at the end of people giving a crap about dystopian and post-apocalyptic. And I was very fortunate. My agent even said as soon as she got it, gosh, if I would have had this a year ago, you might have exploded. But as it is, we're going to be happy with getting it out there. And we might even have missed that curve. I did go out on sub for 6 months, and I had many rejections that were highly complimentary and said, I wish I would have had this manuscript a year ago. But the market saturated.
And I think that kind of happened with Control. We had passed the peak of dystopians, but it was still selling really well, and it got picked up right then and there. By the time it actually comes out, people were getting a lot of fatigue with dystopian. Yeah. I remember Not a Drop to Drink just being so different from what was already out there because of the setting, the voice and the tone. I remember when I read your book, I was like, this is still going to stand out quite well.
It did pretty well in sales. I think that, again, if it would have been a year or 18 months earlier, it might have exploded. Maybe not the way Hunger Games did, but it would be more well known. I am happy with it just existing like that. You know, that was my very first published book. I had been working my ass off for 10 years just to have a published book.
That year was just an amazing year. If listeners are out there, I don't know if you guys realize that Mindy and I were in the same debut group, the Luckies, and we were just so happy. That year was magic. That year was like everything was new and wonderful, but it was also, it came with a lot of sobering realizations mm-hmm. about real life.
It became a much less about the art and more about the business. And that's what we needed. We had to learn. It's not all glitter cannons and ticker tape. A lot of sobering moments. That's kind of the reason why I wanted to start this podcast in the first place, because most authors, what we talk about in our social media is the good stuff. You don't want to tell aspiring authors, yeah, it's really hard and you're going to cry a lot.
Absolutely. I mean, people don't really want to hear that. But at the same time, I know that I personally would have enjoyed having the reality check. I think the one thing like never ever to let go of is be invested in a story that you care deeply about. I think for an early writer, for a young writer, someone who's starting out, you have to be able to believe in the story so deeply that you're willing to suffer some hurt through the process. I think there are a lot of people out there who are maybe better than I am about looking at writing as a business. Maybe they're doing some IP work. Maybe they are ghosting. They could be doing all sorts of other things and using their abilities. And I am so impressed with that. I don't know if you guys understand what IP work, but it's like intellectual property work where a publishing company might be like, hey, we have this great idea. And they're like, we just need mm-hmm. a writer to do it, and they'll find somebody who will take their story and make it happen.
My understanding of those IP works and in-house projects like that, and I could be wrong because I've never done one, but my understanding of those is that the project is a little more managed. In that case, you don't have as much creative freedom as the writer because it's not your idea. They want you to shape it a certain way. My experience with all of my editors has always been, in the end, it's your book. You decide how this is going to play out.
Yeah, I mean, that's been my experience as well, as far as my own books are concerned. The couple friends that I have who've done IP work, some publishers I think have been extremely like, these are the beats that need to happen. And there are other ones that are like, we just want these three elements and go have fun with it.
Coming up next, covers that do a great job, or a terrible one, of conveying what the book is about, and Lydia's amazing genre-jumping lineup of work to come. Oh, also we talk about goat testicles. We're talking about your first book, Control. Control was partially inspired by Undine's Curse. Tell us a little about that syndrome and how it led you to a sci-fi novel for teens.
Right before I started writing Control, I was actually taking my internal medicine board recertification exam, which is this like monster exam you're supposed to take every 10 years that tests you on everything that you have probably forgotten or not forgotten. And I had to study really intensely for a month. And when I was doing that, I came across Undine's Curse, which is more technically called CCHS, or Central Congenital Hypoventilation Syndrome. Most people don't have to really think about breathing. It's an unconscious thing. When you exercise, you breathe faster and harder and deeper. And when you're sleeping, you don't breathe as heavy. And your body regulates how much oxygen you need and how much carbon dioxide you need to get rid of. But people who have CCHS or Undine's Curse have problems with autonomic or automatic control of breathing. It completely takes over their lives. I mean, a lot of them are on ventilators and are constantly in and out of the hospital. And it's a very, very difficult disease. But I knew very little about it. And I honestly, at the time, I thought, what would it be like to have to worry about every single breath you took? I would love to see a character who had to battle every minute of her day. I would love to see her become a heroine. And I'm really interested in human anatomy and physiology and pathology since I'm a doctor. And it wasn't too difficult for me to start imagining what kind of world there would be where people who do have altered mutations might be considered the enemy because they're different. Nobody wants other people to play God when it comes to the human genome. So that's kind of how the story began. Once I finished the book, I did contact a patient and her mom in the community and had them look over the story so I could make sure that I got a lot of the physical stuff right and that I was appropriate and real and respectful. And I did the best that I could. And I think if I had to rewrite it, I would probably do it with not so much of an ableist perspective. I was more immature in my writing then. It was a really amazing journey to try to create that story and make Zelia a real living, breathing character for people to invest in.
I wanted to talk to you about your original cover for Control. I thought it was a beautiful cover. It was actually posted online for a short period of time. I'm talking about the red one. And it was so striking and beautiful. However, it did not work in any way. So I want you to talk a little bit about your cover switch situation and factual basis for covers, I guess.
Oh, look, you can still find it if you Google. I'm like, I wonder if it's still on the internet somewhere. It is.
Awesome.
Google Control Cover Kang, it will pop up. When it came time to make the cover, my editor, Kathy Dawson, who is an amazing editor, she was like, you know, I love this story and I really just want it to pop off the shelf and be different from the other books that are out there. And I said, that sounds awesome. She and the cover artist at the time came up with several different ideas, but this is the one that they showed me. And it basically is a cover that has red blood cells all over the front with this really simple type of control, like in the middle of this one big red blood cell. Mm-hmm. It is very striking. I mean, if you saw that on the young adult section of a bookstore, you'd be like, nothing looks like that. That's amazing. I had issues with it because one, when I looked at it, I thought this looks like a hematology textbook. And then I showed it to my babysitter at the time. And I was like, what do you think of this cover? And she goes, what are those, pillows? And I was like, oh no, I don't even know what they are. What if they just think they're like red pills flying around? The biggest issue I had was that Control is a story about people who have genetic mutations, meaning in the nucleus of the human blood cell where the DNA is, there are these aberrations. And red blood cells in your body don't actually have any nuclei. They have no DNA. So I had to tell Kathy, and I'm like, there are some issues with this. And she was like, oh, good point. You know, it's a good thing you're a doctor and you pick up these things. After really thinking about it and addressing my concerns, they said, you know what, we should try to do a different cover. But that meant pushing the title back a full season. So instead of coming out in August, I ended up coming out in December of 2013. So there was a slight price to be paid, but it was all for the sake of really finding the right book. I'm happy in the end that the cover did change.
Usually with covers, we'll go through 3 or 4, sometimes more, before they actually settle upon one. And it's for reasons like this, where there's simply an inaccurate reflection of the book. Sometimes it's through rather silly reasons. There are many covers that I can think of that don't really represent the book, whereas the character might be described physically differently than she's portrayed on the cover and things like that, or he. And I think that that is one of those things where you decide what you're willing to, as the author, put your name on and what you're not. For you, you were like, I'm a doctor. This book is about DNA, and red blood cells don't have DNA in them. And this cover has red blood cells on them. And if this goes out with my name on it, that's professionally kind of embarrassing.
Exactly. I was like, yeah. My colleagues are going to like laugh their asses off. That was part of it for sure. And I have to say, I was very lucky because Kathy and my team at Penguin, they were really responsive to a lot of the cover stuff that I had brought up. The covers that it ended up being, that you can see like now the paperback ones, were actually what I had originally asked for way, way back when. I didn't want a person on the cover. I wanted it to be gender neutral. I wanted to have this sort of like dystopian feel to it. Everybody talks mm-hmm. about how like fantastic the cover of The Hunger Games was. And
your paperbacks, and I need to mention that Control has a sequel called Catalyst. The paperback covers then are widely divergent from the hardcovers, correct?
Yes. And again, that had nothing to do with me. A lot of times, the way that Penguin works is that when something goes to paperback, it switches to a different imprint. So it goes to Speak, whereas before I was in Kathy Dawson Books. So Control was the hardcover was with Dial Books. The paperback is with Speak, the imprint Speak. And then Catalyst is actually with Kathy Dawson Books because she got her eponymous imprint at that point in time. But when you go to paperback, many houses will just redo the cover altogether. I never quite understood that. I think it's just a chance to give a book a fresh look and another chance to sort of be new and out there and get more sales. I was really happy with both of my Control covers. The first one has a beaker and test tubes and it has a scripty title, and I love them both. It's kind of funny. I try to stay off of Goodreads as often as possible.
That's smart.
Every once in a while, I would like pop back on there and I would see people yelling and getting really upset about the cover change. And I'm like, I can't control that. I can't control that. It's not my, despite the title of the book, like I don't have control.
Yeah.
Over that.
No, I have no control over control. That's all marketing, and marketing has the final say in everything.
Exactly. And I'm like, please don't be angry at me. But I was lucky because I loved both of my covers.
I'm a genre jumper, but I think you might have me beat. You debuted with Control and Catalyst, which were sci-fi YA titles. You have a very dark paranormal short story in the anthology Among the Shadows. Mm-hmm. This fall, you're releasing an adult historical mystery. Mm-hmm. And are also co-authoring a nonfiction book about some of the not-so-great ideas in medicine's past. So what sends you on all these different paths? And is there one that you like best?
You kind of fall in love with certain ideas or concepts and you just go with them. I was at this weird juncture where every year I was writing another book or two and sometimes they weren't selling and I was just trying to come up with more ideas to write about. And this weird thing happened where I was trying to sell 3 books at once. And it's not like I'd written them all at once. One of them was a proposal. So Quackery is a nonfiction adult and we sold that on proposal. So I didn't actually write that book. Nate came up with the idea and we put the proposal together and try to sell it that way. A Beautiful Poison is the adult historical that has a lot of forensics and chemistry in it. That was the book of my heart for quite a while because it had a character who was working at Bellevue Hospital, which is where I did my med school and residency, and it has a huge amount of history behind it. And it was during the influenza epidemic and World War I, things that I'm just really passionate about. And so I had written that one before as a YA, and it just wasn't quite coming out as a YA. It was really speaking more as in the adult genre. And so I was trying to sell that. And then meanwhile, I had November Girl on the back burner that I'd written. And there is a running theme, I think, in most of my books, which is this sort of science medicine thing that I'm kind of fascinated with. I'm also sort of fascinated by death.
Me too.
Yeah. There's a saying that like all poetry is about love or death, and I think that all authors are obsessed with like love and death.
Oh, absolutely.
They're in all of these books. Like, quackery is just about, oh my God, all these really bizarre things and dangerous ways that people were trying to cure themselves. And they, even with the best intentions, no, you don't want to be like, you know, sticking an ice pick in your eye. No, you shouldn't be eating large quantities of mercury. It just, it blows our mind to try to wrap our heads around why we did that. And so Nate and I ran with that because it was such a fun idea. November Girl, which is coming out in November of 2017, perfect enough, was a story that I wanted to do. I had this kind of obsession with Lake Superior, even though I'd never been there before from like books that I'd read as a kid. And I just really wanted to, and shipwrecks. I'm terrified of shipwrecks. So I decided.
God, me too. Something about something man-made that is underwater and completely subsumed by nature scares the shit out of me.
Yes, exactly. And so I was like, I'm going to take that and I'm going to make it even worse because I'm going to make somebody who like is doing it on purpose because this is how she needs herself. It was just this like really macabre. Yeah, this sounds like fun. That is what really gets our blood just on fire, is the idea of walking that fine line between like life and death and why people make choices, and these choices could just completely blow up your world. That's the stuff that gets me tingling. I'm like, ooh, I want to just write about that. So there are themes in everything that I write, even though they take me to different genres. I don't have one of those agents. Eric has never been like, you need to stay in your lane. You need to write YA science fiction and nothing else, or else I'm not going to. He's not like that. He's like, you have a great mind for these kinds of really weird, quirky stories. He's like, go with it. Because when I write with my heart, he likes what I write. When I try to write something that someone else wants me to do, it comes out flat. Luckily, I've been very supported to go in multiple directions. It's going to be a really weird year.
Got a lot of stuff coming out back to back to back. And it's so, I mean, all of it is compelling, I find.
I don't know if there's one person who's going to like it all, but it's going to be fun.
Well, there is. There's me. So
I hope you like it. There are gross things in everything that I write. So you're going to love it all, Mindy. You're going to love it.
That's perfect for me. I do have a quackery question. Do you happen to have, I read this entire book. It's called Charlatan, America's Most Dangerous Huckster, The Man Who Pursued Him in the Age of Flim Flam by Pope Brock. It is in 1917, and it is nonfiction about a man who tried to cure.
Oh, yeah. I've got it.
He implanted goat testicles inside of men.
See, I didn't recognize the title at first. I was like, you should have just said, it's the black book with the goat on the front. And I would have been like, yeah, I have that book. I read it, and I wrote a chapter on surgery and some of the quackery within surgery that has popped up in history. And so I wrote a lot about this guy, but then Nate ended up taking most of the material because he was writing about men's health quackery. It's in my book. It's in our book.
So the goat testicles made the cut. Okay, so I'm on your Goodreads and I see something here called Cyclo. What's that?
Cyclo's new. Cyclo, I just announced the book deal about 2 weeks ago.
You are on fire.
Yes. Well, this is the thing, is that if you're like me, which I know you are, you get these ideas once in a while, and sometimes the time is not right to sell them. So Cyclo was a book that I had thought of years ago. I got really obsessed with the idea of a living, breathing bioship, like a spaceship that had a lot of organic components. So people would be sort of, I don't know, kind of like parasites living in the ship. But like all things, you know, organic things die. And so the idea is that Cyclo is this ship. It's the first of its kind. It's enormous. It's slowly dying. It's been alive for several decades. In space, everything's finite as far as materials and how many humans can be supported on a ship. And so there's a bioengineer who's in charge of making sure that there are enough humans living on the ship. And she secretly goes against the rules for the population and she creates her own daughter. Cyclo helps take care of this child in secret. You can actually embed yourself in the sort of gooey matrix of the ship and it supplies your nutrients and you sleep in there. And Cyclo curates your dreams while you're in there. It's great. And then, you know, you sort of pop out and do work for the day and do your thing. She's been hidden, this girl, for all of her life. And she wakes up after being in this sort of sleep embedded in the wall of Cyclo for longer than usual. Not usually it's 1 to 2 days, but for like a week, Cyclo keeps her in there. When she finally wakes up, she realizes that the ship is completely empty. Nobody knows that she exists on the ship, but now they're all gone and she's by herself.
Oh my God, I have to read this book.
So she is terrified and awkward and weird because she hasn't interacted with any humans, just her mother and just Cyclo. And so she's just a really strange girl. The secondary part of the story is that knowing that Cyclo is dying, obviously the ship has been abandoned by its crew. We don't know exactly why the mother left her behind. And there is this mercenary crew who land on the ship, and their job is to document the death of the ship because it's the first ship of its kind. They need to see exactly what's going to happen, what kind of chemical processes are going to happen, what's going to die. You know, how are the environmental systems going to hold up? So they're there to watch the ship die, but they are going to die on the ship. The core of Cyclo has been storing a lot of radioactive material, cosmic radiation, and that sort of thing. And so they will be hopelessly contaminated by the time they finish their data gathering. It can't be done by computers because the computers are breaking down. So they land on the ship, and lo and behold, this empty ship is not empty. There's a girl there, and nobody's allowed to leave the ship. They can't get in touch with the crew that has left them. And so it's this girl who has never really had a chance to live, who's going to die. And then there's this boy who has committed himself to dying, who finds love for the first time. And so that's the story.
Oh my God. I want to read it. According to Goodreads, that will be coming out in 2018 from Entangled.
Yes. That will be coming out with 2018 with Entangled. Entangled is publishing The November Girl as well.
Next up, Lydia talks about taking questions for Medical Mondays, a service her blog offers for aspiring writers who need medical input. We talk about the importance of getting things right for the sake of your reader. I share one big thing I totally got wrong, and we end out with common writing and publishing misconceptions, as well as where to find Lydia online. I want to talk to you a little bit about your blog. I know it might not necessarily be continuously updated now, but back in 2013, you were doing Medical Mondays, where writers can ask you questions concerning injuries, recovery times, historical healing methods, just about anything medical that will help them with their research as they draft. You know, and I know, that I have sent you more than a few rather heinous emails concerning terrible things.
Your emails start off with, like, I just want to say I'm not a bad person, but.
But if I took a human being and I did this to them.
Like, if I put them in a blender, would they survive? And I'm like, Mindy.
And you're like, I've met you. You're normal.
But then the funny thing is that I end up answering the question like it's no big deal. And I'm just like, okay, this is what happens if you do put a human in a blender. That's one of the fun things about doing these kinds of medical questions. My blog is quiet these days, but I still get questions via email that are like Medical Mondays questions. And you have a medical issue that needs to happen in the book, but you're the author and you're plotting things at the same time and you need things to work with your plot. The fun thing about doing medical fiction consultations, which I guess is kind of what I'm doing, is that you get to work with both things. So there are some static things like what happens in science, what happens in your human body that just you can't fictionalize well. But then there's the fictional aspect that you can work around and you have to figure out how to make them both work. So a lot of times I get people who are like, I need this person to be almost dead, but I also need them to be like running up and climbing a cliff 2 weeks later. And I'm like, okay, let's get to work.
I can find a disease to fit that.
Exactly. And that's what we do, is that we find diseases to work. I tell people like, hey, that disease is not going to work. Oh, you know who also asks me questions all the time? Elle Cosimano. Elle wrote Nearly Gone. She writes a lot of thrillers that often have this tiny little bit of paranormal element to them. Yeah, she's killing people off left and right too. And so she sends me these emails like, hey, Lydia, guess what? Like, I need to do some acid stuff. And I'm like, all right.
That's the kind of thing that I think is indicative of an author, published or aspiring, who is determined to get it right. And I think that's really important because as a reader, when I am reading something, for example, and I won't say what it was, but I was reading a published book and it was a good book. There was a scene where a person was injured by a wild dog that swiped at them and they were hurt in their arm by the dog's claws. That's something a cat does. Dogs don't do that. When you get hurt by a dog, you get hurt because they bit you. A cat will swipe you. This person's injury was a huge part of the story. You know, it was a big plot bump. And the whole time I'm reading it, I'm going, a dog doesn't do that. A dog doesn't do that. Even a wild dog doesn't do that. And it was just, as a person that knows animals, understands them, and sees their behavior, I was like, oh my gosh, that's just not right. And it threw me out of the story. And it bothered me.
Yes.
And it's not necessarily the fault of the author. It's just a little thing. And I can give you a great example of something I didn't know when I was writing Not a Drop to Drink and In a Handful of Dust. I worried so much about water. The methods for disinfecting water in Not a Drop to Drink, you can use them. I made sure that everything about water was in there accurately. I was so down to the details about how people were using their food and their water. I had people operating trucks and cars and using gas-powered things like chainsaws and log splitters about 30 years after society collapsed, and the books were already published when someone informs me that gasoline deteriorates and can no longer be used about 2 years after production.
Ooh, I wouldn't have known that either.
I mean, for me, this is devastating because the books are already published. Gasoline plays a part, a big part in the second book, and it's not right. And it bothers me when I mention this other book where I'm saying a dog swiped someone with their paw and severely injured them. And I'm like, oh my God, that would never happen. I'm not saying that I never make mistakes. I'm just saying as a reader, I noticed this mistake. I think that it is a compliment to authors who want to get something right, especially if it's medical, because that's tough. That's something that you really have to dig in if you want to get it right. I think that it's really cool that you offer up your expertise to help people to that extent to get it right.
It's a lot of fun to do. I mean, I'm not perfect. I do my best with it. Losing a reader because they get pulled out of the story for something that's not believable is like our worst fear. We always talk about getting lost in a story, and you can't get lost if your own reasoning starts to question what's going on in the story. I've lost interest in several books because of that. I know when I've read something really good where by the end of the book I've forgotten that I was reading. For me, it gets harder and harder the more that you write to get lost in a book like that. I think you and I have talked about this. Like, I'm kind of obsessed with Laura Ingalls Wilder and all of her books. And you know, the way that they had to survive in the pioneer days was so harsh. If you threw me out into the pioneer world, I would be able to survive because of Laura Ingalls Wilder books. And when I read your stuff, I remember being like, she's getting the stuff down, gritty and real and dirty and hard. And I was like, go Mindy, this is awesome. For me, I can't not pay attention to those details. And when I get them wrong, or if I get them wrong, I'll always be like kicking myself afterwards. I'm still waiting for a molecular biologist to read my book and being like, okay, this is what's wrong with it. And I will be like, bring it on. I want to hear everything.
No, me too. I'll be like, tell me more because I needed to know what I did wrong. It's just a function of being a lifelong learner. I'm always learning. I always want to know more about so many different subjects. So when I learned this, I was on a panel and I was sitting next to another post-apocalyptic author who said she hadn't read my books, obviously, because she said everybody who has gasoline in their books in the future needs to know it stops working after about 2 years. And I'm sitting there next to her like, oh, shit.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. I mean, and this is probably also the moment where you're like, and that's why if there is an apocalypse, I'm going to hang out with all my author friends because we all know how to survive.
The last thing I want to ask you about is common misconceptions for aspiring authors and maybe even just the general public when it comes to being an author and writing in general.
It took me a really long time to learn this. You know, when I went to college and medical school and stuff like that, and I decided that I was going to become a doctor, there was a very clear pathway. And you could not just hang your hat and be like, all right, I'm going to be a doctor today. No, you have to go take your MCAT, take all these required courses. Then you got to get into medical school, but you got to do well in medical school. And then once you're in medical school, you got to try to get into a decent residency. And it was a very clear set of things that you had to do that you had to do really well. And I love that. I work very well with those sort of constructs. So when I decided that I was going to maybe start writing, I didn't start until 8 years ago. That was when I'd already been a doctor for 9 years or something like that. And it's because I never thought I had the permission to write. I thought I needed an MFA. I needed to be an English major. I just thought I needed some sort of badge that I didn't learn. And it didn't occur to me that I could actually just do it and learn along the way. That being said, the corollary to that is like, no, you don't need a degree to start writing, but you do have to learn a crap load of stuff. And you have to be really, really dedicated to admitting that you are not a perfect writer and that what you first come out with is going to be awful. And I I had to be extremely open to feedback. I mean, when I started giving my stuff to other people to read, I basically was like, I was very humble. I'm like, look, I don't know what I'm doing. I don't have a degree in this. Tell me everything that I'm doing wrong so I can get it right. And I think that helped me learn very, very quickly. So that's probably one of the huge things that I learned first off when I started writing. And then the second thing I learned was just because you get an agent or a publishing deal does not mean that you have your toe in the door forever and that you're going to become Neil Gaiman and you're going to become J.K. Rowling and everything's going to be beautiful and perfect. And
yeah,
I have since written some things that haven't been published and may never get published. Penguin has been fantastic. I am now working with Macmillan and Entangled Teen. I'm now working with Workman Publishing. I'm with Amazon Publishing imprint of Lake Union. All amazing, amazing people, wonderful editors. I could not be happier. But if you told me when I first started that I was not going to be this lifer with one publishing company, I would have been shocked. I would have been like, that's not the fairy tale that I bought into. And that being said, I think it has been a better thing for me because I can write many different things and please many different audiences, and I don't have to be confined to one genre. It was a shock to me when I was like, what? We don't all just get this like lifelong contract and they're just going to eat up everything that we put out. That was a big shakeup for me, but I learned fast. Yep. I think we all learn fast. I think there's so many people in our debut group who are not with their original publishers anymore, or even with their original agents. Things do change. It's not this like you land in the fairy tale and you're done.
It's constant work and constant reimagining of yourself and finding new avenues. I think that it's a very introspective journey in many ways because you learn about yourself and you learn what you're good at and what you're not good at, what your limits are. I know that I will probably never write a romance. That is not in me. The other thing for me, as far as common misconceptions, is money. People think that if you have a book deal that you're good. That's just simply not true. I make enough to get by. And that's about it. And that's great for me. That's a huge blessing. I am a full-time writer now, and I make enough to get by, and I am just getting by, but I'm getting by.
You're the exception, I think. Another friend who writes full-time, and she does well, but the majority of my author friends are not living fully on their incomes. It's not like it's some salary you get. You can have a year where you get nothing and yeah, another year where you get lots. It varies. That is definitely, you need to keep your day job for as long as possible. And do not assume that the second that you like sign that first deal that you can give it everything up, because it doesn't always work that way. I think that there's some people who go into this because they want to be famous and they want to make a ton of money. But that's your shtick and that's what you want to do. That's fine. I know personally, if that was what my goals were, I would have given up. I think the reason why I kept going was because I find the work fascinating and fulfilling and interesting, like endlessly interesting. I am in love with the idea of writing something that someone else can be entranced by. If you don't have that going into this, then it's going to be difficult for you.
Yes. And, you know, when I get those tweets, it's 3 a.m. and I can't put this book down. Mini Beginners, thank you. I'm just like, that is why I wrote this book. That's why I wrote any book.
Yes. I don't want to, again, like discount the people who are really, really good at writing for the sake of keeping the money rolling in, because mm-hmm, that takes in a whole other set of skills that overlap with ours. You know, it is a scramble. You are hustling all the time, trying to get that new book out, trying to get that next story, trying to figure out what the market is going to do and still stick to your deadlines, you know, that are just constantly. I have a deadline that just dropped into my inbox this morning. I've got first pass pages I got to do. So you are kind of like on this little treadmill where you're throwing stuff out into the world and things are getting thrown at you. And the whole time you're just trying to stay on. It's pretty fun. Yeah. A little, you know, it's a strange existence. That's for sure.
It's a strange way to make a living. I just did a school visit the other day. I was speaking and the kids just flat out asked me, how much money do you make? And I told them and they were like, what? That's it? They said, you should be making bank. And I'm like, yeah, I know. Like, if you knew how much I worked, if you knew, if I actually broke it down to what I would get paid by the hour, I have never done that and I never will.
I don't think that's a very safe thing to do.
Nope.
I mean, I suppose if you're planning out your income for the next couple of years, it's kind of a necessary thing maybe, but I'm really lucky. I have a a working spouse and mm-hmm. I work part-time in medicine. I am really happy keeping this sort of balance of seeing patients and writing at the same time. But if you're going to go into this as a profession, you really need to work out the financials before, during, after, and handle all the what ifs, because you could have a fantastic 2 years and be making a really, really decent income, and then it could just dry up in a snap. And that's hard to predict. Yep. So
it's impossible to predict. You never know what's going to be around the corner. And, you know, and I can say that as someone that has 4 books out and 4 coming in the next 2 years. And in 3 years, I could be working part-time in sales. Like that's, I can say that with some reliability. You just don't know.
You just don't know. And so, I mean, the only thing that you can kind of really stick to is just keep writing and write stuff that you love, because that is what makes you happy for the moment. And that's the reason why you do it anyway.
To finish up, why don't you tell us your social medias and where people can find you online so that they can follow you and see what you're up to.
Oh, sure. So you can find me on, I'm probably most active on Instagram, at Lydia Kang. And I'm on Twitter a little bit. That's at Lydia Y Kang. You can also find sort of updates about what's going on in my book life on my website, LydiaKang.com. So I'm around. You can find me. I love interacting with people and hearing from you. So feel free to drop a line on any of those venues.
Writer, Writer, Pants on Fire is produced by Mindy McGinnis. Music by Jack Corbel. A special thank you to fellow author Alyssa Palombo and patrons Stephen Avery and R.C. Lewis for helping to make this episode possible. If you find the blog or podcast helpful, please consider showing your support by visiting patron.podbean.com/writer-writer-pants-on-fire and making a donation. I'm your host, Mindy McGinnis, and we'll be back next week with another episode of Writer, Writer, Pants on Fire, where authors talk about things that never happened to people who don't exist.